You're listening to Popstar Conversations, taking you inside with your favourite musical artists.
Chuck and I are sitting here with Michael Stipe of REM. Michael, thanks for coming on the show.
Michael, thank you for being with us today. Why did you guys decide to end REM at this time?
It was important to each of us that we are able to leave on a high note and we're able to do it the way that we would do it the way REM would do it, which is on our own terms. And that was something that I think, looking at the way most bands fall apart or kind of fizzle into nothing or end in these kind of explosive, I hate you, you hate me, speak to my lawyer, all that crap that happens. It wasn't going to happen to us, but in doing this the way that we did it, I think that we were able to do it in a very REM way, which was on our own terms and at a point that we considered to be a high point in our career. So we're very happy with the last two albums that we made, and we're very happy with the last tour that we did, and we're very happy with each other, and we're very happy with what we've done. So it was a good time to just say, that's it, we're closing a door.
So you guys just didn't want to sign a new contract?
Well, the idea of signing a long-term contract for anyone is kind of absurd, right? So we could have done whatever we wanted to do. There are plenty of templates of people created their own rules. We could have done something like Radiohead if we chose to release a record online exclusively or whatever. Sign a contract for one record with any label that we wanted to, probably. But no, I mean, I think it was more a matter of convenience that the contract was up, and it provided us with a moment to sit back and reflect and say, what have we done? What are we going to do from here? And how do we feel about that? And what we arrived at was that it was time for us to call it a day.
So your single, All the Best from the Last Album, was that a clue of things to come?
Yeah, it's a big fucking fat hint, if you ask me. The whole record, I mean, the whole of Collapse Into Now is us, in a way, saying goodbye and making the best record that we can possibly make, the best album. We still believe in the idea of an album, including my extension of the sonic part of the album by bringing in all these artists and filmmakers to do something that I'd wanted to do for years and years, but had never had the time or the energy to do or the money. And that was to do a film for each song on a record. And somehow kind of bring the idea of an album into the 21st century in our way. But we knew from the cover art is, I think, the first time that the band has ever been portrayed on the cover of an album. And I'm gesturing with a wave, which can be taken in any number of ways, but I would say it's a goodbye.
So now the future is all yours.
Future is wide open. I mean, too, you know, if you want to take that even further in terms of Collapse Into Now, you have a song that opens the record with Discover, which is me as a 19-year-old in New York looking at the opportunity that city provides and the freedom to create of your life anything that you want it to become, all the way to the last song, which ends with Patti Smith, and then swings back into the first song. And so it's about the beginning and the end, and it's a little obvious, but it's, you know, it's a rock record. It's not the greatest American novel. It is what it is.
Was it difficult for you to announce to your fans that you were retiring?
It wasn't easy. I mean, it was difficult. We worked very hard on the wording of the announcement, and the phrase "call it a day" is something that we thought, this is going to translate to people who are not English speaking. We're not breaking up because that sounds very negative, and we're not splitting. We're not ending because the music will continue. Our friendship continues. Our love and respect for each other continues. Everything continues. Except that we will no longer make records and record together. We'll no longer tour together and make music on stage, and that's that. So we worked really hard on the announcement. It was bittersweet. It was difficult. It was sad. It was liberating. it was even funny at times, trying to come up with the exact right words. And putting it together was not easy. But again, it reflects, you know, the thing that I'm most proud of with REM is that we own the triumphs and the very high points, and we own also the mistakes and the very low points. And I think that's significant, and I think it's very important that we did it our way. We took advice from other people, and then we either listened or didn't listen. Every choice that we made was ours, and that includes the very best and the very worst of who we were as a band.
Michael, the title of this record, what were you implying? What were you suggesting?
The part lies, part heart, part truth, part garbage. That's actually Peter from, I don't know when, someone asked him, you know, describe REM, and that phrase came back around when we were trying to come up with what would you call Changes One by David Bowie, you know, for me, a very significant introduction to an artist who I knew about. I knew what he looked like. I knew maybe one song, but when Changes One came out, I was 16. I was already listening to Television. I was already listening to Patti Smith and the Ramones and Talking Heads and Blondie. And I knew about the punk rock scene in London. And then David Bowie, this kind of artist who I knew had been around, releases this compilation. And it's called Changes One, and it's got this beautiful picture of him on it. And it was my introduction to his work, his body of work. In putting together this retrospective, I wanted to provide that same experience for the teenager of 2011 to a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old somewhere in the world who maybe has heard Losing My Religion or Everybody Hurts as elevator music, or as whatever plays in the background at the department store when your mom's buying lettuce. But it has no resonance in your life. It's just that thing that plays in the background. I wanted to provide some kind of a package that could impact them the same way that Changes One impacted me. And that is to provide a window into a body of work that's quite amazing.
It must have been quite difficult to put 15 albums into 40 songs.
Yeah, everyone has the song that they think should be on it, and the song that they're sorry made the cut. But we gave ourselves a very interesting, I thought it was actually a little bit old-fashioned, but fairly modern in its old-fashionedness. We gave ourselves the limitation of what could fit onto two CDs, as this is how many songs, because I could put 80 songs on, but an 80-song record doesn't provide that teenager with what they need to. I really wanted this to be something that people will pick up or listen to who have no idea who REM are, and they can be proud of that, or they can find something from it. People who know REM will look at it and go, that's a pretty good representation. I would have put Find the River on, and I wouldn't have had The Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight on there, or whatever. You know, everyone's going to have an opinion.
But it's been really incredible throughout the years. So many other artists have covered your songs.
It was pretty incredible. Yeah, it was kind of incredible. And we were very humbled and very flattered. And, you know, as I said, it was bittersweet. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but we did it.
After working so many years with this band, how do you feel at the close of it?
Everything I've said, it's bittersweet, it's sad, it's a little bit funny, it's odd. I find myself not so much at a crossroads, but a little bit a feeling of liberation a little, and also no real pressure to answer the question, what are you going to do next? Because I don't know what I'm going to do next, and I feel like I deserve, after 31 years of doing this, a couple months to kind of just do nothing and float and try to figure out what I'm going to do next. I'm not a lazy person, and I don't like I like things very, very fast, and I like to. I mean, I just have a lot of ideas. I'm an artist, and I things come in, and I want to put them back out again. So it's not like me to slow down or to take a breath. But I think now, if there is a time to do that, now is the time.
Looking back on the band's history, what are you most proud of?
That we did it our way, and that we listened to advice, but we didn't always take it. And whatever choice we made, we own. And that includes the very highest and the very lowest points. So the parts that I think are terrible mistakes and are embarrassing and are that I'm actually horrified. You know, the worst haircut of the 1980s was my haircut on the Green World Tour. That was awful. It was about six bad haircuts rolled into one, which should have been, to anyone paying attention, it should have been a pretty good indicator of my mental state at the time and the level of exhaustion that we had reached having performed nonstop and recorded nonstop for almost a decade. But, you know, we took our time off for 5 years and then we went back to it. There are terrible mistakes, but I'm really, honestly, to be able to own those mistakes along with the triumphs and the high points is something that I'm very proud of.
The last three songs that the band recorded, We All Go Back to Where We Belong, Hallelujah, and A Month of Saturdays, are they entangled in some way?
Well, the three, we did them all at the same time, so I don't know which one would be the last song. But they complement each other in a weird way. I mean, it wasn't intentional, but each of them, I think, represent kind of something about REM. And there's one that's very quick and kind of stupid and fun and kind of it's like a very dry sense of humor, and maybe everybody won't understand that it's funny. They might just think it's really bad. So that's A Month of Saturdays. Then there's Hallelujah, which is kind of devastating and beautiful and elegiac and provides, hopefully for me anyway, but provides some degree of revelation or some epiphanal thing. And then there's We All Go Back to Where We Belong, which can be interpreted in all kinds of ways, but it's just one of those songs that kind of tugs at your heart and kind of hurts when you listen to it, but it's a good hurt. So each of those kind of provide, I think, you know, some kind of roadmap to our, you know, three of our strengths as a band.
I'm curious, how did Kirsten Dunst get involved in the video?
When I was recording that song and I was writing it, I was finishing the lyric and we were in the studio and I was still kind of writing it. I kept thinking of her and John Giorno. I had seen an exhibit of Screen Test by Warhol, by Andy Warhol at the Museum of Modern Art. And I'd seen John there, in fact, because he participated in some of the Warhol films. And he's someone that I met through William Burroughs in the mid-90s and who I admire immensely. And he's an amazing artist. And he's this incredible, charismatic, like...
Do you have any film projects on the horizon?
I have, yeah. There are some film projects that have been in the works for a while. One of them is quite interesting. It's a documentary about the internet and instant celebrity on the internet. And so we'll see where that goes. But there should be news about that in the coming months. Working as a producer, though, is a very different thing from. You know, it's not, it doesn't provide the same charge that I get as an artist. It's a very different thing to support other people making artistic decisions and creation. That said, I enjoy doing it. When it's good, it's great. And a film like this, which I think is actually kind of significant and timely, it's good to work on.
Your bronze sculpture exhibit, was that something of a time capsule?
Thank you for asking. The comment is... It's about ephemerality, and I took it to a very absurd end, which was, here's this object that we all fetishize on some level. It's an object that is now, for all intents and purposes, obsolete with the advent of digital photography, digital imagery, and new technology, emerging technology. This is a thing of the past, and yet we fetishize it, and we feel... this inability to throw it away. We'd rather put it on the shelf and look at it rather than and acknowledge it as an object in and of itself in a sentimental and nostalgic way rather than what that object provides, which is snapshots, literal pictures of our life. And so it's a distillation of a weird train of thought or separation from ourselves, our lives, our emotions, how we interpret that through this object. I then take it and, of course, I make it out of one of the earliest metals that we were able to As you know, as mankind kind of progressed, bronze was one of the earliest metals that we were able to kind of extract from the earth and create tools and things from. And then the idea of okay, the world comes to an end. All plastic things are destroyed. All kind of ephemeral things are gone. All the pictures are gone. All the digital files are gone. And here's this blob of bronze that represents or this object from the late 20th century. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Michael, thank you for being here, and honestly, good luck.
Michael, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you again for listening to Popstar Conversations. Be sure to click the subscribe button below and hit the red bell so that you'll be notified of our next exclusive interview.
Thank you for listening to Popstar Conversations. Please join us again for another conversation with your favorite musical artist.